Chapter 63. Slowly, reluctantly, Pitt rose from the black depths of a sound sleep to the brightly lit surface of consciousness, only to find it was accompanied by stiff, aching pain. He tried to go back and re-enter the comforting void, but his eyes blinked open, and it was too late. The first thing he focused on was a smiling, red face.
"Well, well, he's back among the living," said First Officer Finney cheerfully. "I'll go and inform the captain."
As Finney passed through the door, Pitt moved his eyes without moving his head and found a little bald-headed man sitting in a chair beside the bed. The ship's doctor, Pitt recalled, but the name escaped him.
"I'm sorry, doctor, but I can't recollect your—"
"Henry Webster," he second-guessed Pitt, smiling warmly. "And if you're wondering where you are, you're in the finest suite on board the Lady Flamborough, which is currently under tow by the Sounder for Punta Arenas." "How long have I been unconscious?" "While you were making your report to Colonel Hollis, I was tending to your wounds. Soon afterward, I put you under heavy sedation. You've been out for about 12 hours."
"No wonder I'm starving."
"I'll see our chef personally sends down one of his specialties." "How are Giordino and Findlay?"
"Most admirable of you to inquire of your friends before yourself.
Giordino is a very durable man. I took 4 bullets from him, none in critical areas. He should be ready to party by New Year's Eve."
Findlay's wounds were far more serious. Bullets entered his right side and lodged in a lung and kidney. I did what I could for him on the ship. He and Giordino were airlifted to Punta Arenas and flown to Washington soon after I put you out. Findlay will be operated on by bullet wound specialists at the Walter Reed Medical Center. If there are no complications, he should pull through in fine shape. By the way, your friend Rudy Gunn felt they needed him more than you did, so he accompanied them home. Before Pitt could make a reply, a digital thermometer was slipped in and out of his mouth. Dr. Webster studied the reading and nodded. "As for you, Mr. Pitt, you'll mend nicely. How are you feeling?" "I don't think I'm up to entering a triathlon, but except for a throb in my head and a stinging sensation in my neck, I'll manage." "You're a lucky man. None of the bullets struck a bone, internal organ, or artery. I stitched up your leg and neck, or, more accurately, your trapezius muscle. Also your cheek. Plastic surgery should hide the scar, unless, of course, you think women find it adds to your sex appeal. The smack on your head caused a concussion. X-rays showed no sign of a hairline fracture. My prognosis is that you'll be swimming the English Channel and playing the violin within 3 months." Pitt laughed. Almost immediately he tensed as the pain struck from every side. Webster's look became one of quick concern. "I am sorry. My bedside manner tends to get a bit too jolly, I'm afraid." Pitt relaxed, and the agony soon subsided. He loved English phrasing and humor. They were a class act, he thought. He smiled gamely and stared at Webster with unconcealed respect. He knew the doctor had downplayed his skill and labors out of modesty. "If that hurt," said Pitt, "I can't wait to get your bill."
It was Webster's turn to laugh.
"Careful. I wouldn't want you to ruin my superb needlework."
Pitt gingerly eased himself to a sitting position and held out his hand. "I'm grateful for what you did for the three of us." Webster rose and shook Pitt's outstretched hand. "An honor doctoring you, Mr. Pitt. I'll take my leave now. It seems you're the man of the hour. I think you'll have some distinguished visitors gathering outside. Goodbye, Doc, and thank you." Webster gave a wink and a nod. Then he walked over to the door, opened it, and motioned everyone inside. Senator Pitt entered, followed by Halla, Colonel Hollis, and Captain Collins. The men shook hands, but Halla leaned down and lightly kissed Pitt. "I hope you've found our ship's service satisfactory," said Captain Collins jovially. "No man ever recuperated in a fancier hospital," Pitt replied. "I'm only sorry I can't bask in such luxury for another month." "Unfortunately, your presence is required up north by tomorrow," said Hollis.
"Oh, no," Pitt moaned.
"Oh, yes," said the senator, holding up his watch. "The Sounder will be towing us into dock at Punta Arenas in another 90 minutes. An Air Force transport is waiting to fly you and Miss Camille and me to Washington." Pitt made a helpless gesture with both hands. "So much for my luxury cruise." Next came the usual round of solicitous questions concerning his condition. After a few minutes, Hollis turned the conversation to his current problem. "Would you know Amar if you saw him again?" he asked Pitt.
I could pick him out of a lineup easily enough. Didn't you find him? I gave you a detailed description of his height, weight, and looks before Doc Webster knocked me out. Hollis handed him a small stack of photos. Here are pictures taken and processed by the ship's photographer of the hijackers' bodies, including those taken prisoner. Do you see Suleiman Aziz Amar among them? Pitt slowly sifted through the photographs, studying the close-up features of the dead. They had seemed faceless during the battle, he recalled. He wondered with morbid curiosity which ones were dead by his hands. Finally, he looked up and shook his head. He's not in here among the living or the dead. You're sure? Asked Hollis. The wounds and death-like expressions can badly alter facial features. I stood closer to him than I am to you under conditions that aren't easily forgotten. Believe me, Colonel, when I say Amar isn't among those pictured. Hollis pulled a larger photo from an envelope and passed it to Pitt without comment. After a few seconds, Pitt gave Hollis a questioning look. What do you want me to say? Is that Suleiman Aziz Amar? Pitt handed the photograph back. You know damn well it is, or you wouldn't magically produce a picture taken of him at a different time in a different place. I think what Colonel Hollis is holding back, said Dirk's father, is that Amar or his remains have yet to be found. Then his men must have hidden his body, Pitt said firmly. I didn't miss. He took a shot in the shoulder and two in the face. I saw one of his men drag him to cover after he fell. No way he's walking around. It's possible his body was buried, admitted Hollis. An extensive air and land search failed to detect any sign of him on the island. So the fox hasn't been run to ground, Pitt said softly to himself. The senator looked at him. What was that? Something Amar said about a coyote and a fox when we met, Pitt replied pensively. Then he looked around at his audience. I bet he's eluded the net. Anyone care to give me odds? Hollis gave Pitt a dark look instead. You better hope he's deader than a barracuda in the desert, because if he isn't, the name of Dirk Pitt will head his next hit list. Hollis wept gracefully to the head of Pitt's bed, wearing a gold silk dressing gown with a modernized hieroglyphic design. She placed her hand lightly around his shoulder. Dirk is very weak, she said in an even voice. He needs a good meal and rest until it comes time to debark the ship. I suggest we leave him alone for the next hour. Hollis slipped the photos back in the envelope and rose. I'll have to say my goodbyes. A helicopter is waiting to take me back to Santa Ynez to continue the search for Amar. Give my best to Major Dillinger. I shall. Hollis seemed uneasy for a moment. Then he approached the bed and shook hands. I apologize, Dirk, to you and your friends. I sadly underrated you all. Anytime you want to transfer from NUMA to Special Operations Forces, I'll be the first to sign a recommendation. I wouldn't fit in too well, Pitt grinned. I have this allergy to taking orders. Yes, so you've demonstrated, Hollis said, smiling faintly. The senator came over and squeezed Pitt's hand. See you on deck. I'll bid my farewell there also, said Captain Collins. Hollis said nothing. She herded the men from the room. Then she softly closed the door and turned the lock. She walked back until she stood beside the bed. The folds of the gown plunged, and there was something in the casual way it draped her body that convinced Pitt she was naked beneath. She proved it by loosening the sash and shrugging the gown from her shoulders. She heard the whisper of the silk as it slid down her soft flesh. She posed like a bronze statue, breasts thrust out, hands flattened against her thighs, one leg slightly in front of the other. She reached down and pulled back the bed covers. I owe you something, she said huskily. Pitt caught his reflection in the mirrors on the closet doors. He wore only white gauze. The top of his head and the side of his face were swathed in bandages, as was one side of his neck and the wounded leg. He hadn't shaved in a week, and the whites of his eyes were streaked with red. In his mind, he looked like a derelict any self-respecting bag lady would reject. I'm a sorry excuse for Don Juan, he muttered. You're handsome in my eyes, Hollis whispered as she gently lay beside him and lightly trailed her fingers through the hairs of his chest. We must hurry. We have less than an hour. Pitt let out a long sigh. He would catch hell from Doc Webster if he overexerted and pulled out his stitches. Abject surrender. Why is it, he wondered, men plan more covert schemes than an intelligence agency to seduce women, only to have them turn on under crazy circumstances when you least expect it? He was more convinced than ever that James Bond really didn't have it all that great. When Amar awoke, he saw only blackness. His shoulder felt as though a piece of coal were burning inside his flesh. He tried to lift his hands to his face, but one hand exploded with pain. Then he remembered bullets striking his wrist and shoulder. He raised his good hand to touch his eyes, but the fingertips felt only a tightly bound cloth that wrapped around his head, covering his face from forehead to chin. He knew his eyes were beyond saving. Not for him a life of blindness, he thought. He groped around for a weapon, anything to kill himself. All he touched was a damp, flat rock surface. Amar became desperate, unable to repress the fear of helplessness. He struggled to his feet, stumbled, and fell. Then two hands gripped his shoulders.
"Do not move or make a cry, Suleiman Aziz," came the whispered words of Ibn. "The Americans are searching for us."
Amar clutched Ibn's hands for assurance. He tried to speak, but could no longer utter coherent words. Only animal-like guttural sounds came through the blood-caked wrapping supporting his shattered jaw.
"We are in a small chamber inside one of the mine tunnels," Ibn spoke softly into his ear. "They came very close, but I had time to build a wall that concealed our hiding place."
Amar nodded and desperately tried to make himself understood. It was as though Ibn could reach through the pitch darkness and read Amar's thoughts.
"You wish to die, Suleiman Aziz. No, you will not die. We will go together, but not 1 minute before Allah decides."
Amar slumped in despair. He had never felt so disoriented, so completely out of control. The pain was unbearable, and the thought of living out his days in a maximum security jail cell, blind and mutilated, devastated him. All instinct for self-preservation had deserted him. He could not stand being dependent on anyone for his hourly existence, not even Ibn.
"Rest, my brother," said Ibn gently. "You will need all your strength when it comes time for us to escape the island."
Amar collapsed and rolled to his side. His shoulders came against the tunnel's uneven floor. It was wet, and the moisture seeped through his clothing, but he was suffering too much pain to notice the added discomfort. He became more and more despondent. His failure had become a horror. He saw Ahmad Yazid standing over him, smirking. Then a curtain slowly formed and parted deep in the recesses of Amar's mind. A faint glow appeared, a glow that bloomed and then burst in a blinding flash, and in that one chilling moment he glimpsed the future. He would survive through revenge. Mentally, he spoke the word over and over until at last his self-discipline returned. The first decision he came to grips with was who should die at his own hands, Yazid or Pitt. He could not act alone. He was no longer physically capable of assassinating both men himself. Already a plan was forming. He would have to trust Ibn to share in the revenge. Amar anguished over the decision, but in the end he had no choice. Ibn would draw the coyote, while Amar's final act would be to slay the viper.